Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, in the Milton Bradley board game, Life, you get a job, you get some security, and then you can have a child. But in reality...
My name's Stephanie. I'm calling from Fort Worth, and I had an employer that insisted on me working 70 hours a week through tax season. And then after the baby was born, fired me promptly.
My name is Sharon Green. I'm calling from Wareham, Massachusetts. I worked for Physician Sales and Service at the time, 5 hours after delivering my son. My boss called me to ask me some purchasing questions. He knew how committed I was to the job, so he really shouldn't have called, but he did. And 3 days later, me and the baby were back at work with a bassinet in my office.
Yeah, that's no game. Kids are cute, but just not apparently to some employers. More from you on this subject and some others a little later on this hour. We'll also have an update from Mexico and Ukraine. We'll hear about the Christmas tree harvest this year. Hint, the energy from all those burned up trees will power a lot of lights come January. This being the season of goodwill, we'd love to know how big your tree is this year and how much it cost. Also, another look at income inequality and a modest proposal for narrowing it from Nobel economist Robert Shiller. But first, today, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear Young versus United Parcel Service. Peggy Young, a UPS driver who sued the company under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, a law passed by Congress in 1978. When Young became pregnant, her doctor advised her, as most women are advised, not to lift more than 20 pounds. Young asked for a light-duty assignment under a program UPS had in place for other workers, but the request was denied. At just 14 weeks pregnant and unwilling to disregard her doctor's orders, Young took leave without pay for the next 6 months. She also lost her medical coverage before having her baby. Now she's suing to get back pay along with a recommendation that her rights were violated under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Pregnancy, of course, is completely normal, and employers are required to make reasonable accommodations for other workers with physical conditions under laws like the Americans with Disabilities Act. Yet many employers seem to consider pregnancy an imposition or bringing a baby to work to be something like showing up with a disruptive Great Dane, an unwelcome distraction. Is this case about outmoded gender notions or about the rights of businesses to set their own rules on their own property? Jillian Thomas is an attorney and author of the forthcoming book, Because of Sex. She says this case may be a hard one for the court to work through.
In the pregnancy context, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act has a clause that requires that employers treat pregnant women who need accommodation the same way that they treat employees who are similar in their ability or inability to work. And so employers have sort of fumbled with this requirement. It's not as clear as the requirement under the ADA.
No.
Yeah. And the issue that has been brought forward by this case is what exactly is a worker who is similar to a pregnant worker? So in the case of Peggy Young, the case that's before the Supreme Court, UPS, her employer, did make accommodations under its policies for three different categories of workers, none of which it found included pregnant women.
And in this case, why isn't it as simple as you bring an excuse from your doctor that says you can't lift more than 20 pounds and that's the end of it?
Well, I think employers consider it a cost issue, or they certainly cite the potential burden on other employees. And I think that that is a human concern. I think most people have had the experience of being in a workplace and feeling in one way or another that they're being asked to, quote unquote, pick up the slack for someone else. I think that's really a fundamental framing of the workplace as a place where the ideal worker is the only kind who's welcome, one who's able to come in at 9, leave at 5, never needs to take time off for kids, never has a need for their workspace or their work hours to be altered in any way. And employers view any deviation from that, whether it's people with caregiving responsibilities or physical impairments view that as burdensome. It's ironic, though, that employers say that because the data is legion that providing accommodations to workers and making it possible for workers to stay on the job in whatever form actually increases retention, reduces turnover, increases morale. And a coalition of business organizations did submit a friend of the court brief in this case to the court explaining it's not that difficult to make accommodations. In virtually every workplace, there are tasks or projects or things that have always needed doing that could be done by folks who need accommodation.
I remember in the original Americans with Disabilities Act, writing of that legislation, which I think is flawed legislation in many ways, there was this concern that, oh, gosh, it would open a whole can of worms. And if some people were granted certain accommodations, then everyone would want them. And we have seen a proliferation of people who have disability stickers running around and using parking spaces that they really aren't appropriate for. But in the case of pregnancy, that's not going to apply. I mean, I can't sort of pretend that I'm pregnant to get some sort of co-worker's benefit here. So I just wonder why the court would take the employer's view that everyone has to be normal so seriously in this law.
I think what we're running up against in this case are stereotypes about pregnant women that are deep-seated and go beyond the physical repercussions of pregnancy. And the notion that having a child makes you a less committed worker, both in terms of your commitment to putting in the hours and your commitment to staying in the workplace for many, many years. So I think that what we're up against is these deep-seated predispositions and stereotypes, which the Pregnancy Discrimination Act was passed to eradicate and which still persist. But the reality is that 85% of women are going to be pregnant at some point in their working lives and probably more than once. Women experience a vast array of physical complications from pregnancy, even in a quote-unquote healthy pregnancy, that are going to be interfering with job responsibilities, especially as you see more women moving into male-dominated fields, policing, construction, law enforcement, firefighting. So it's a conflict between stereotypes that we have about mothers and their abilities and the reality of a physical event that is major and that most women are going to experience.
You know, these stereotypes that you talk about, I mean, they're really deep-seated. I mean, we're talking about employers trying to maintain a fiction of the ideal worker that really goes back to medieval times when there were huge pools of workers that you could just sort of use. And if somebody, you know, lost their hand, you basically say goodbye and you just take the next person who's standing in line. It seems to me that in the modern workplace, focusing on the individual aspects and attributes of each worker is a good strategy, whether they're pregnant, whether they have a certain disability. I mean, certainly management goes out of its way to give special parking spaces to, you know, different people, depending on whether they're a vice president or a director. It just seems like the whole doctrine is based on a fiction that eventually is going to collapse of its own weight.
I think that that's a great service that the Americans with Disabilities Act did for us and an important cultural shift that it started in terms of making people realize that it's a very rare person who goes through their entire working life without some sort of adverse event. And some of those events are permanent and some of them are temporary. But helping employers and people understand that as human beings, we come into the workplace with family relationships, health issues, things that are going to interfere necessarily. And I think that thinking and that shift needs to occur with pregnancy. And we need to reconcile this notion that people are automatons coming into the workplace.
Exactly. I mean, this is a philosophical question. The idea that, you know, we're going to pretend that people don't have caregiving responsibilities. We're going to pretend that people don't get pregnant. We're going to pretend that people don't have differing abilities, whether we're talking about disability or just differing abilities. And yet, you know, someone has a ski accident and they come in on crutches and everything's fine. But pregnancy is viewed as some sort of huge issue that has to be dealt with. Is there a complication in the law in the sense that when corporations are viewed as people in, say, the Hobby Lobby case, for instance, where corporations have the right to dictate certain sort of ideological questions, religious questions on the workplace, does this complicate how this gets dealt with by the court, because they're going to give a lot of latitude to the corporation because it's viewed as a person with the same standing as a worker.
Yeah. Would that women got the same degree of indulgence and sympathy that the owners of Hobby Lobby did with respect to their beliefs about contraception. I think that's a very real concern. I mean, I think that the best hope that the litigants have in this case, the petitioner, Ms. Young, and her lawyers and advocates supporting her, I think the best chance that they have is to focus the court on the legislative history of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which was passed 36 years ago. Its promise has never been fulfilled. And to look at the circumstances that surrounded the passage of that law, which, by the way, came out of a Supreme Court decision very similar to the lower court's reasoning in the Young case, and to look at what was the purpose of this law and what are the continuing effects of pregnancy discrimination, what are the real-world impacts. And for all of this court's flaws and blinders about real people's lives, they do tend to, obviously with exceptions, but they do tend to notice and understand real-world impacts. And if the outcome of this case is really going to be that you have pregnant women in a vast range of jobs needing a temporary kinds of accommodations, and we're saying that they're not entitled to those, and yet vastly expanding swaths of people who qualify as disabled under the Americans with Disabilities Act do get them, then where are we left and where have we come in 36 years?
Jillian Thomas, attorney and author of the upcoming book, Because of Sex. Thanks so much. Lots to think about in this case, and it goes way beyond pregnancy, that's for sure.
Thanks for having me.